hppodcraft.com.
Over the wind's midnight howling, in the demoniac swirl in the mountain rainstorm, came the frantic cry of a man harassed by some hideous mental torment.
Doc Croft, for God's sake, open up before it's too late!
Tim Croft, recently assigned by the state health authorities to take charge of this tiny charity hospital in the deep Ozarks, came abruptly awake as he heard the agonized call punctuated by an insistent hammering on the front door of his cabin, which was located to one side of the hospital proper. He slid his feet into worn slippers, made a light, crossed the cabin's single room, and opened the rough, hard-hewn door. A spindrift of rain flurried at him, and with it came the man who had called out so despairingly. He was Jeb Starko from up in Haunted Hollow, a mile beyond the ridge, an area bedeviled according to local superstition by ghosts and similar evil creatures of the night. Soaked to the skin, his unshaven face pasty with fear, Starko stumbled over the threshold.
"You got to stop 'em, Doc," he mouthed. "They're a coming to get my Eula."
"They're coming to get my Eula." I thought about opening the show with like a couple of verses. A sort of 1940s ukulele kind of song.
Okay, let's do it.
So in my head, I'm going, "Coming to get my Eula." Oh, hey, you have it right there. "They're coming to get my Eula. What rhymes with Eula? Let me think. I guess it's Dracula." Wait a minute. How could the people of Haunted Hollow not be suspicious of this woman? She's already half a Dracula.
It's true.
That's how songs bring us all together and bring deeper understanding.
That's beautiful. That was the opening of Blood for the Vampire Dead by Robert Leslie Bellum. We've done two vampire stories this month now, so January is also half Dracula.
That's right. Half a Dracula sounds like a hangover drink. So does Blood for the Vampire Dead. It sounds like it would be an expensive cocktail on a blackboard in some hip gastropub.
Oh, yeah.
Is that really $16? It is a cool name. When I read it, I go, you know what that is? That's the Tura Satana of short story titles. It's so cool. Yet another among the many cool titles that we read here on HP Podcraft, Strange Studies of Strange Stories, nay, the HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We are exclusively on Patreon, so thank you for joining us.
Who was that reader?
That reader is Owen Elliott, former lawyer, former chef, former municipal counselor, and now current awesome dude. He's a huge fan of pulp writers, and he's working on completing his Conan the Barbarian comic collection, and I think that is a noble goal. He lives up in Nova Scotia, Canada, with his wife and daughter. He is a treat. Thank you, Owen.
In order to get into the character of Jeb Starko, our reader, I don't know if you know this, moved to the Ozarks in Missouri. And I know this because I'm suddenly getting notices that we owe rent down there. Shoot. So I called him up and I said, "Look, the deal for reading on the show is we'll promote whatever you want, but this level of research is not really something we talk about." Being a first-time reader, I just thought there was some confusion, but he said, "No, well, you know, I'm promoting this Shakedown."
Oh.
That's what I'm promoting.
Well.
That it was just really quiet on the phone. Somebody disconnected eventually. So that's where we're at with that.
Okay.
But thank you for reading. How about this author?
We don't really know a whole lot about Robert Leslie Bellum. He was born in 1902 in Philadelphia. He moved to LA. He worked there as a newspaper reporter and a radio announcer. And he even had some work as a film extra.
All right, a fellow tradesman.
He wrote for the pulps and is most known for his character, Hollywood Private Dick Dan Turner. He wrote for Spicy Detective, Spicy Adventure, Spicy Western, and Spicy Mystery. Which it seems kind of odd that they're also spicy, but spicy was to let you know that there was some sexual content in the story. Of course, these were very tame by today's standards, but it said that he wrote over 3,000 pulp stories over a period of 30 years.
Whoa, that's an amazing amount of work.
Yeah.
The pulps, I guess there are sales records to let us know, but because of the nature of what they were, disposable. Yeah. You know, we don't really know how many of these things somebody would own or how much time people spent reading them. Mm-hmm. I've been weirded out lately at how comfortable television ads are with the word binge. I just see it in all of these ads that'll say, "For your next binge, this television show," things like that. And I always think, aren't there some negative connotations to this word?
Yeah.
You really can't sell other products like that. You know, when you put Blood for the Vampire Dead, the cocktail on the blackboard, you can't write "For your next binge" next to it. That would be... bad, even if it's honest, about how a lot of these things are consumed. I guess my point is just that when you listed all those spicy magazines, I kind of imagine somebody buying them all from the newsstand and taking them home in a big stack to binge over the weekend. Because the sheer number of publications and stories that these authors we talk about pumped out.
Oh, my God.
It wasn't just something to pass the time on the train. These pulps were Netflix. These were television. Yeah. This was what people would consume a lot of, which is kind of crazy to think about somebody sitting down and reading just a ton of short stories. But it must have been happening.
Yeah. I mean, it makes perfect sense. They didn't have TV and there was just radio stuff to listen to. And that you couldn't really control on what, you know, what was on or what you were feeling like in a particular mood. It was on. It was on. If you don't want to listen to The Shadow, oh well, that's what's on right now. However, if these pulps, you could like anything that's in the short stories, so you can just kind of read them for, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and like, oh, that's good. Move on to the next thing. There's an author you like, a type, you want some spicy mystery? Here you go. You want a little spicy coal miners? They got a whole story of that. It's all
there. Yeah, they were very niche. So it's just one of those things, I guess. It's not a big surprise. But we think of things as being different now in some way in terms of how we consume this stuff. But it's not really.
I don't think so, yeah.
It was just different avenues of how to get to the content.
Absolutely. Yeah. After the pulps went away, Bellum got work on television as a writer. And he wrote quite a bit. He wrote for The Lone Ranger, Dick Tracy, Superman, The Adventures of Superman, which I've watched tons of those as a kid, Perry Mason, and a ton of other stuff. He died in 1968 at the age of 65. This story, Blood for the Vampire Dead, was published in 1940 and was in the March issue of Mystery Tales. Sadly, not spicy.
I'm really glad we're learning this 1940s jargon. I didn't actually know that spicy meant there was some sexual content. I was laughing because next week's story, Batman, is in one of those. I think it's in Spicy Mystery where it was published. Even though it's not a lot. I know what you mean, that it's pretty tame by today's standards. But I'm glad that I know spicy means that, because I don't want to be in a situation, you know, I'm thinking about if I ever time travel, I don't want to be in a situation where I'm in like a 1940s diner and I say, hey, can you make it spicy? And then the waitress slaps me. What kind of gal do you think I am, Junior?
You know, what's funny about that is that woman would call you Junior.
It's meant to be insulting, I think.
Okay, sure.
Look, if I'm time traveling, I'm still young. I can have whatever I want in my wish fulfillment examples.
No, I just thought that was an extra level of comedy you had going on there. So that's all. It's a credit to your writing. Our story begins with Dr. Tim Croft. He's been assigned to a small charity hospital deep in the Ozarks. We get the impression that he's a bit of a city slicker and the locals don't care much for his type. He is awakened in the middle of the night by a frantic man, Jeb Starko, from Haunted Hallow. Needless to say, has a very bad reputation for being, you know, supernatural place. Jeb is there to take his wife, Eula, away from the hospital because the Ludwells think that she's a vampire. Jeb says that they're going to kill you, Doc, to get to her.
Now, Doc Croft knows something that Jeb doesn't know. It says he choked back the gloomy news he had for the Mountaineer.
But Doc Croft, he's not taking any chances, so he gets a handgun, puts it in his pocket.
I thought it was a cool dynamic right out of the gate, because the doctor is, like you said, seen as a city slicker. It says the Ludwells were members of a clan which, from the very outset, had fiercely resented his coming to the region as only the deeply superstitious can resent progress. More than once, they had muttered dark threats against him because of his efforts to educate the natives away from their beliefs in herbs and charms and devil magic filters. That's that word. Filter again, with a PH, meaning some kind of magic potion. They're saying as how Eula is a witch vampire, like the haunts that roam the ridge and they're aiming to kill her. Now, I wasn't sure who to ally myself with at the beginning of this story, the doctor or the townspeople.
Yeah.
I didn't know who was right. After Dr. Satan, a lot of my assumptions about storytelling have been upended, so I was really lost.
It's true.
Coming into this one, yeah.
A woman shows up from the hospital. Doc Croft lives in a little cabin outside of the hospital, but she's one of the nurses. She's Brenda Lemoyne. Now, Brenda is Dr. Tim Croft's love interest and will soon be his wife once he gets that promotion. He's a young guy, right?
Yeah.
Because calling him Doc Croft makes him sound old. So I guess we should call him Tim.
Yeah.
But damn it, he has earned that medical degree. I feel like it's not fair calling him just Tim.
That's the argument Dr. Satan would make. Tim Satan. By the way, there are a lot of full names getting thrown around this story. When Brenda shows up, it says, "You should have stayed in your cabin with Edith Paxson," he said gravely. Referring to the nurse who shared duty with Brenda. I guess they live in a dorm in the hospital together. But when somebody talks like that using full names, that's the first symptom of a body snatch, I think.
Oh,
you know,
right?
It's really weird. Happens throughout this story.
Croft tells her that the Ludwells are on their way, and she says, "Lidge, or Lige?
I don't know. His name is spelled L-I-G-E, so I was saying Lige Ludwell.
Lige. Well, I went online to, and there's so many different pronunciations of it, so I don't know what is intended. So we're going to go with Lige. She says that Lige Ludwell is bad news, and they hate us. Lige, of course, is the leader of the Ludwells.
And Edith, her roommate, it's mentioned, is missing, by the by. She goes, I went in and she wasn't there. So that's important. There's an awful snapshot of Lige Ludwell's cruelty after Croft, because Croft says, I can handle these yokels.
Mm-hmm.
And Brenda says, well, Lige Ludwell is dangerous. Only today, down in the village, somebody told me Lige turned his own daughter out into the storm after whipping her with a leather strap because she'd fallen in love with a boy Lige disliked. A man capable of doing a thing like that is capable of doing uglier things.
Just then, the Ludwells show up, a group of grim-visaged men slogging forward through the ankle-deep mud. Three carried lanterns, while the remaining pair bore a limp burden that sagged gruesomely between them. It was the inert form of a young girl, stripped stark naked and horribly pallid in the lantern glow. This is the first of a lot of unnecessary nudity in the story.
Well, you could just say nudity. You don't have to characterize it as unnecessary. That's a judgment. Don't spice shame me.
But why is she naked? And wouldn't they, like, if they're carrying her around and it's his daughter, you would think, well, put something on her. Don't carry her around naked. I don't want people looking at my naked daughter.
Well, it's not just young girls who are nude, though. If you want to zip back and listen to the opening of this episode, it says, Doc Croft slid his feet into worn slippers, made a light, crossed the cabin's single room, and opened the rough, hard-hewn door. So if I'm reading that correctly, this whole time he's been standing there in only slippers.
Oh, geez.
Otherwise naked. They didn't mention any other garments.
That is true.
Yep. He got up naked, put on slippers. He's standing there naked as well. This is the Ozarks, man.
Oh, okay. Croft, from the distance, thinks that the girl that they're carrying is probably dead, and he also is pretty sure that it's Lige Ludwell's daughter. They tell Doc Croft, Weans want the witch vampire. Lige claims that Eula is the vampire and that she killed his daughter and drank her blood. Of course, Doc Croft tells them that there's no such thing as vampires and that they're wrong about Eula. Jeb pleads with the doc not to let them take her. She's just sick, he says. Tim gets serious at this point. See, he doesn't feel right, Tim. Dr. Croft gets serious and says, I'm afraid it's worse than that. She died this afternoon.
That was the gloomy news he had for this mountaineer, Jeb. I'm sorry I had to be naked when telling you this, Mr. Starco. Now that I think about it, it's pretty unnecessary nudity. There is a robe hanging right over there, but I don't feel like putting it on, Mr. Starco. I'm very sorry. Tell you what, I'll put this head mirror on and hang the stethoscope around my neck so you know I'm a professional. You can call me Tim, but as long as I've got the stethoscope on, it's clear I'm a doctor. We could talk about what may have happened to your wife.
So Doc Croft explains that Eula was suffering from a rare disease, nephrosis, which is a kidney disease, right?
Yeah.
Lige ain't buying it, and he wants to see the corpse. Croft says, I'll let you take a look at her, but first I want to see what happened to your daughter and find the cause of death. So he notes that there are four puncture wounds on her neck that look like they could have been caused by an animal. And Croft wants to know how it happened, and they tell her that they just found her hanging in a tree upside down. Her body was still warm to the touch when they found her, but there was no blood under her. It was all gone.
That was a genuinely creepy image. Very non-human, but also natural in a way. You know, an animal might have a specific disposal strategy for the remains of prey. Mm. Stuff it somewhere so it doesn't reveal their presence.
Croft, he's not buying it. He says, you know, it rained today and the blood got washed away. And obviously, first of all, this is a murder. Somebody's been killed. Someone else is trying to make it look like a vampire did it so they can get away with it.
It does make sense that it would wash away, and that's why there wouldn't be gallons of blood on the ground, mm-hmm. or at least that, you know, you wouldn't be able to tell.
Croft says, I heard you whipped her and kicked her out of your house for having a love affair. When the doctor says this, Lige thinks, oh, okay, you're accusing me, and he goes into a rage. He vows that he's going to kill the doctor and the nurses. Then Doc Croft pulls a gun and says, keep your distance. So good thing he had that gun. And he says, look, Eula died at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You found your daughter still warm tonight. So there's no way that she could have killed her.
How dare you accuse me of hurting somebody after I beat my daughter in public with a leather strap? Not a murderer.
Lige counters, witch vampires can run around when they're dead. And, check and mate. He's right.
He keeps saying witch vampire, which means they might have several other types of vampires in Haunted Hollow.
So maybe there's a werewolf vampire and there's a ghost vampire.
That's what I mean, yeah.
All those types. Croft says, look, I'll take you to the body and I'll prove it to you. She's dead.
He couldn't remove the body during this horrific rainstorm, so it's still there in the hospital.
They walk in, and of course, the body is gone.
Brenda Lemoyne's hand flew to her mouth. Tim, she gasped. Are there other Brendas in the room? In a similar question, why did we have to use her last name?
Jeb is angry and accuses one of the Ludwells of coming in and stealing her. He moves to attack them, but Croft holds him back. But then Lige sees something pretty incriminating.
Everyone raced to the door through which Lige pointed, with the doctor in the lead. He tried to shield the gruesome sight from Brenda Lemoyne.
In the little white-walled room, the missing night nurse, Edith Paxson, hung suspended upside down and naked from an overhead rafter, her curvesome body swaying gently like a pendulum, and her flesh a horrible fish-belly white. Exactly like the wounds on the throat of Lige Ludwell's daughter, there were a series of sharp incisions over Edith Paxson's jugular, and ruby rivulets ran down from the punctures to drip slowly on the floor. But the flow of blood had almost ceased, and that was a strange thing, because in spite of the obvious fact that the nurse's veins had been completely drained, there was practically no blood on the floor beneath her head. Just a few spattered drops, and that was all.
Man, the sadism is off the charts in this one.
It's kind of uncomfortable for me. I wasn't really expecting it, because the stuff we generally read is not like this. Again, she's naked. Why? If this vampire is taking blood from her neck and holding her upside down, why does she need to be naked? Obviously, that's something that the author thought would make it erotic. I don't know.
Well, that's the thing about it. It's the way that it's mentioned, you know, her curvesome body.
Yeah.
You know, nudity is only sexual to me in context.
Of course.
You know, if somebody's naked and hurt, there's no sexuality in their naked body at that moment, right? So that's the weird thing about that is it's definitely a lot more of a, because this person is incapacitated, I can look at their nude body. That's really more of what that's
about.
Yeah. And that's creepy.
It's really creepy. And
that's a creepy instinct to be appealing to in a fictionalized setting.
If they wanted some steamy stuff in here, they could have a scene between Brenda and Tim.
Are you talking about Brenda Lemoyne?
Yeah. There's a creepy element to the story that I find very unappealing.
Well, it's all over the pulps, the sexualized violence towards women.
With this, Brenda is starting to get on board with this whole vampire idea. But Croft thinks that this is just another murder. And he tells Lige not to touch anything and that he's going to go to the sheriff, who's in the village not far away. Lige says, don't worry about it. We're going to go vampire hunting. And Jeb says, I ain't going to let you, and punches Lige.
Yeah, he's going to protect his wife at all costs.
Now, Lige is angry, but he doesn't hit back. And he tells Croft that he's going to get what's coming to him for harboring a vampire. And then the Ludwells leave.
Croft took Brenda's arm. I hope the car will run, he said slowly. Something tells me we haven't seen the last of this business tonight. Well, a horrific Richard Speck-like murder just happened to your girlfriend's roommate in your hospital.
You would think that maybe he would know her and maybe kind of be sad about her dying. You know, he works with her in the hospital, so.
Yeah, instead it's more like, I think this is going to go on for more than one night. Can you believe it? I think we're going to have to deal with this maybe a second night. Brenda does my favorite Paul Perrin move here. It says, she crouched close to him in the car as if seeking the protection of his hard body. Tim, I'm frightened. I love it when a woman tells a man she's frightened. Maybe that's revealing a kink for me. Oh, I like that anytime in a B movie that the woman just leans into the guy and goes, oh, you know, John, I'm so frightened. I'm so frightened. By the way, he's ditched the stethoscope and head mirror at this point because of the car. So he's got driving goggles and a fedora on. Otherwise, still just slippers.
Just slippers. It's the Ozarks. Croft and Brenda go to his car and they drive towards town. But because of the rain, the roads are super muddy and they get stuck. Mm-hmm. As Croft goes out to inspect his car, he is struck from behind and knocked out cold. He wakes up. Brenda is gone, and he's not sure how long he's been out.
But you could see everything while he was knocked out. Everything. He's fully dressed, actually. That's what's weird. Somebody knocked him out and put clothes on him. He wakes up in a three-piece suit. What? Cover my shame, will you?
As Croft wanders around in the rain looking for Brenda, he wonders if he's right. Until tonight, He would have scoffed at such an eldritch, hellish fancy, but in view of what had already happened, a cold slime of horror slid into his marrow when he considered the possibility that the Ludwells had been right in accusing Eula Starko of vampirism. And while his reason rejected such an idea as fantastically impossible, his instinct compelled him to find out for himself, to learn the truth, one way or another.
His instinct compelled him to find the truth, not his missing fiancé. Glad they made that clear. Because I thought, well, if she's missing, why wouldn't the character just move on with his life? But, oh, he's got an instinct to solve this. That's good.
He makes his way to the haunted hallow, the Starko cabin. And when he looks in the window, he is shocked to find Eula Stark is sitting at the table with bowls of blood in front of her and streaks of blood running down her face.
That image kind of shocked me. I didn't know what was going on. Vampire drinking blood out of bowls.
Yeah. She was staring at the window, her eyes glassy and expressionless, and crimson streaks drooled from her mouth down her chin onto her breast. Oh, see, her breast! Why does that
That's just gravity. That's gravity. It has to go there.
Yeah. Just then, he hears a scream in the distance, and it's Brenda. So he runs off to find her.
These pulp writers all seem to do things like this here. It says, "There came a thin wailing scream, a woman's scream. Terror spawned and hideous, as if ripped from the throat of a girl whose reason topples close to the brink of horrified insanity." It's stacking so much stuff up, but then also this "as if." Why are you distancing it? That's exactly what the scream is. It's like they get the metaphors mixed up with the actuals all the time. You know?
Yeah.
It was as if steel was ripping through his skin as the steel ripped through his skin. It's just a lot of that.
Now, he sees a light in the mountains, but he knows that there's no cabin out that way. And then he hears the scream again, but this time he can make it out. It's, "Tim, help me.
I'm so frightened."
So he heads towards the light. The spot that he goes to is high above the creek bed. It's a bit of a cliff. At this cliff, there's a cave with light coming from inside of it. He hears sobs and looks inside, and he sees Brenda. She is hung suspended by her ankles from an iron spike driven to the cave's left wall. Her clothing has been torn from her lilting body, leaving her charms exposed to the eyes of four Ludwells who hunkered down behind boulders. But at least there were no fang marks on her sweet throat, and she seemed unharmed. Writhing and twisting, she was trying to raise herself in order to reach her fettered ankles. That's pretty sadistic.
Yeah. I mean, like, the vampire hanging things upside down, like, right away I imbued it with so much coolness earlier. I'm talking about prey animals and stuff.
Yeah.
This author's like, "No, I'm trying to get a cover. If I can hang a naked woman upside down, somebody's going to see. I mean, let me get as many of those in here as I can, because it increases the likelihood that somebody's going to draw that."
He tries to get her, but the Ludwells jump him and tie him up. They explain that Brenda is bait for the vampire, and if he doesn't quiet down, they're going to brain him. He tries to tell them about the cabin, but they crack him on the head. Then they shut off the lights. Croft is propped up against some rocks, and he finds a jagged piece that he begins using as a blade to cut the rope behind him.
I always feel like the writer is tired of their own story when something like that happens. If somebody cuts the ropes against a jagged something, or it's a fight and they reach for a weapon that's just out of reach and that's what helps them win, the writer has 100% given up on their story at that point. Don't you think? It's just the laziest. You have a person you set up who's a physician.
Yeah.
I mean, let him use some, take the head mirror off. The one thing he's happened to be wearing is perfect for cutting the ropes, you know.
Yeah.
Use the slippers, something that's on him.
Yeah, exactly. Croft hears someone coming in and attacks. It's Lige, and Croft just takes him out.
He catapults himself at him and tackles him.
The other Ludwells, they go to get Croft, but he tells them, "Quiet, you fools. Someone else is coming. Your trap is going to work. Hide."
There was a slithering sound at the mouth of the cave, and suddenly a hellish crimson effulgence glowed there like devil's fire. Through the dim ruby light, a shape scuttled forward and somebody clattered metallically. Brenda shrieked again, "Tim, it's got me. It's at my throat. I'm so frightened."
The Croft jumps out and grabs the perp. It's Jeb Starko.
"You're all through killing girls for their blood, Jeb Starko," he said as he bore the scrawny mountaineer to the cavern floor and pinned him there. "It's a Scooby-Doo! There were no Draculas."
No Draculas. Croft has it figured out and says Jeb is the killer. He tells them to go get Brenda down, and they do. Jeb is angry that the Ludwells were calling Eula a vampire still.
Croft cast a pitying glance at the prisoner. "You're right, Jeb. There weren't any witch vampires. There was only you and your ignorance of medical methods. I had told you that your wife was suffering from nephrosis, a disease where the blood rejects proteins and refuses to transmit water to the kidneys. The only way to treat it is by transfusion." putting borrowed blood into the patient's veins. You knew we were keeping Eula alive by giving her new blood, refrigerated and shipped here from the county hospital blood bank. In spite of that, she kept getting worse. You conceived the idea that the reason she wasn't improving was because we weren't giving her enough fresh blood. You decided to do something about it.
Yeah, so Jeb had grabbed Ludwell's daughter, killed her, and drained her of her blood. He didn't know anything about blood transfusions, so he was going to feed it to his wife. But the Ludwells showed up and jumped to the wrong conclusions.
I don't know what other conclusions they were supposed to jump to, because it's such a crazy plan.
Yeah.
And like he said, just weird reasoning. So I don't blame them for jumping to that conclusion, no. Honestly. The woman's name was half a Dracula, and they live in Haunted Hallows. So I just can't blame them, given...
Fair point. While the doc was talking to the Ludwells that night, he took Eula's body and he hid it in the woods. Now, maybe Edith caught him. You know, that was the nurse that was murdered, and he killed her because of that. Croft isn't sure exactly about the details. He goes, well, he killed her, but he drained her of blood, too, because he thought it would help Eula. So he took Eula and the blood back to his house and he fed her blood. And obviously it didn't work.
That all, I guess, happened while the argument between the doctor and the Ludwells was going on or something. There was some confusion about timelines here. He's a really efficient killer. That's all I know. I wanted to bring Eula back to life, the man choked. When this revelation was coming out that it was him, it was almost like Let the Right One In, that movie, where the father is getting blood for his vampire daughter. But here the vampire's not a vampire. The father is just a lunatic and kind of stupid. It seems incredible that he would go to this really drastic, I hate to say this, a couple years ago we would have said, why would anybody think of doing this to treat, you know, this medical condition?
Oh, right, yeah.
But oh boy, looking at the world now, I go, yeah, maybe somebody would think that blood's just not fresh enough and not check up on it and just go ahead and do something dumb like that.
Now, Lige hems and haws and says, reckon maybe Wien's been wrong about you too, Doc. Me and the boys are willing to be right friendly-like with you from now on, if it suits you. So Croft and Lige shake hands after that. So everything's cool. You just kidnapped my girlfriend, ripped off her clothes and hung her on a cave wall upside down by her feet. It's a simple mistake. Anyone could have made it.
And hey, let's just pretend I never heard about you beating your daughter in public with a strap. Turn a fresh page.
When they're distracted, Jeb makes a break for it, and he runs out of the cave, but unfortunately he slips, goes over the ledge, and falls to his death.
They buried Jeb Starko and his wife in a single grave the next day. Returning from the simple funeral, Tim Croft held Brenda Lemoyne very close to him.
Love's a queer thing, isn't it, my sweet? He whispered.
It's a very wonderful thing, she answered, and held up her lips for a kiss.
I laughed so hard that they all made up in the end, but also, what do you mean love is a wonderful thing? That's the lesson you're getting from this? I would say love is a horrible thing because this uneducated man murdered people and was feeding their blood to his daughter out of love. Brenda Lemoyne, you really misread this. She's dangerous. I think Brenda Lemoyne's dangerous. I think he's putting that name in there so we know to look out for her.
Yeah, well, maybe Brenda Lemoyne's suffering from some PTSD here and she's just, you know, processing it the only way that she can because some really horrible things happened to her. She saw her friend's horribly murdered body. She was assaulted, hung up, and thought she was going to die. You know, like all these terrible things. And then the man that she cares about says, oh, these guys are all right.
You're right. This is like the end is kind of menacing. She goes, it is a very wonderful, wonderful thing. And held up her lips for his kiss. The doc's going to be hanging upside down naked pretty soon. No slippers this time, doc.
I think this is a pretty bad story.
Well, I'm coming around to that opinion.
I mean, it's called Blood for the Vampire Dead. I'm thinking, okay, that's we're in the black with that.
It started really cool, too, when I liked the setting and the townspeople coming in and then this question, is she or is she not a vampire? Didn't really stick the landing and it had a bunch of this stupid, you know, very juvenile peep show stuff in it.
The female character in the story is not a person. Like, she doesn't have any normal person feelings or thoughts.
Yeah, but she was frightened. She was so frightened.
And I gotta say, I'm bummed out that there wasn't really a vampire because this is just basically a murder, a couple murders. And that's really horrible. And it just made me feel bad.
Yeah, I know.
It reminded me how horrible humans are for a number of times in the story. And it just made me feel bad. So I would highly recommend skipping Blood of the Vampire Dead.
Hey, I want to thank our reader,
Owen Elliott, for again bringing the thunder. I hope that This will help you find the courage that you need to complete that Conan the Barbarian comic collection. And I think it will.
Good luck in the Ozarks, because we're not paying that rent. I also want to thank some patrons who are paying our rents. They're all lovely people. I've got 10 of them in mind here, and I'm going to start by thanking Amy Coetto.
I want to thank Mark. Just Mark.
I'd like to thank Doc Dagger.
Whoa.
Hell yeah.
That's rad. I want to thank Tom Stanhope.
I'd like to thank Sam Marl.
Well, I'd like to thank Sam Middleton.
See, now that is important. These Sams, we would want to separate by their last names. It would be important to mention their whole name. However, in this list, there's only one Max, and so I'm going to thank him just by that name. Max, thank you very much.
I'd like to thank Kimmy Cuso.
I'd like to thank Michael D. Wright Jr.
And lastly, I'd like to thank Alistair Brooks.
Next week, we're going to have another pulp story that I liked quite a bit. It's called Batman. It predates the Batman we all know and love.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a man turning into a bat, so you can't get much better than that.
That sounds awesome.
Thank you for tuning in here on Patreon. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
HPPodcraft.com.